the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan and Dr. David Robey, who is editor of the Asia Pacific Report.nz and a renowned expert on Melanesian and Pacific affairs. And today, in the first of a two-part special, we will analyse how COVID-19 has been a trigger of instability across the Pacific region. And specifically for this episode, we do a deep dive into instability in the Melanesian region, focusing on, and here are the points, security issues in Papua New Guinea, Indonesia's interests in dividing potentially regional groups such as the Melanesian Spearhead Group, and a security crisis that has developed in Fiji after recent detention of 9 politicians and activists who have dared to criticise former military coup leader Frank Bainimarama's government. So let's cross to Paul and David, who are waiting online, and we're going to dig into these issues right now. Good afternoon, Paul, and good afternoon, David. Tēnā koe.
Kia ora.
So, David, let's go to you first. And if you can give us a summary as how you see events that have been taking shape, basically, since COVID-19 started to embed itself into the Melanesian states, the nations. And in particular, perhaps if we look into and go into PNG, obviously West Papua, if we look at Bougainville, and also Indonesia's influences over some of the things that are happening in that region. But David, over to you, if you can give us a summary of what you see is happening over there.
Well, right from the moment that we had the COVID alerts last year, and particularly when New Zealand closed its borders and so on, and was very concerned about the Pacific region, we've seen a dramatic slide in democratic systems and values around the region, and the rise of authoritarianism in an extraordinary way. And governments in the region, particularly Papua New Guinea and Fiji, have used COVID-19 as a major excuse for fairly draconian actions in many instances. Generally using it as an excuse for erosion of democracy in the region generally. And of course, in the background to this, we've got two situations, particularly in Papua New Guinea, with the issue of Bougainville and Bougainville's impending independence, we hope. Bougainville's in the middle of negotiations with the Papua New Guinea government and Prime Minister James Imarapa and so on. The President Tororoma of Bougainville just recently had talks with Imarapa. This is playing out in the background with COVID problems in Bougainville as well. But even more worryingly is the situation with the Indonesian, the shared border with West Papua. We of course, refer to West Papua as a region. The Indonesians don't. Of course, they refer to two provinces, Papua, which is the main one, around the capital of Jayapura and probably two-thirds of the country, and then West Papua is the western second province. But we always refer to West Papua as the region. Indonesia at the moment is escalating. It's being given very frequently now as the major flashpoint, if you like, of COVID-19, the Delta variant. And there's even suggestions that Indonesia could be a very worrying breeding ground for a further variant that can be far worse than the Delta variant and so on.
David, is because of the sheer size of the population, the spread of COVID-19 Delta at the moment, there's every indication that there is a likelihood or a probability, if we put it on that scale, that a variant could come out of the Asia-Pacific region and Indonesia being the heart of it.
Absolutely. And of course, to bear in mind that both Indonesia and Fiji were two countries that resisted lockdowns. In the case of Fiji, of course, you know, it's really dependent on, it's put all its eggs in the sort of herd immunity basket, which has been an absolute abject failure. In Indonesia's case, very little was done in the early stages, and now it's paying the price, and a very serious price it is. And West Papua's caught in the middle of this. And what a lot of people don't realise, in West Papua, the Indonesian government's responsible for both the vaccination campaigns and for treating COVID-19 in West Papua. And Papuans generally have a very high resistance to vaccination, and that's partly because, or probably mainly because, they distrust the Indonesian government authorities and the military. The military is very heavily involved in actually vaccinations and in treating people in the country. And so there's just no trust there. Now, of course, this is very worrying for Papua New Guinea as well. Papua New Guinea at the moment has had serious problems in recent months, but right at the moment, it's not in the situation that Fiji has with the Delta variant, although there have been some cases, but their border cases are largely with Philippine ship or Philippine crew members on a ship that was recently in Papua New Guinea. But really, it's the border. It's this porous border, massive border right across several thousand kilometres from the north to the south. And there was a lot of controversy just recently because Lucas Anembe, who's the governor of the Papua province, and a very influential person and a very progressive leader, with the Indonesians have been trying to dislodge him and to get rid of him or to marginalize him because of recent ill health. Well, of course, he's known for his motorbike adventures and so on. He popped across the border from, you know, Jayapura, where he was based, of course, across to the Vanimo, which is the most northwestern town in Papua New Guinea, for medical treatment. And this caused quite a bit of controversy because he just sort of zipped across the border, even though the borders have actually been closed for quite some time now.
So if we pull this back, you know, you made comment about some draconian measures that had been entered into, or using COVID-19 as an excuse. Can you detail that down? What governments have deployed that kind of thing, and what is the impact on the people and also the economics and the stability in those specific countries?
Well, particularly, I think the two examples here are Papua New Guinea and Fiji. Fiji more so than Papua New Guinea. But Papua New Guinea has actually been using military means generally, and threats, you know, in the country over COVID-19. It's it recently had dealt with in Hela province, for example, where there's a major sort of resource, energy resources, and it's had a history in the last couple of years or so of political instability and tribal fighting. There's been a handover of weapons, but there's no convincing sort of outcome of that could lead to peace. And the other thing is about control of internet and social media. Do you want me to go into the Fiji situation at the moment?
Let's pick up Fiji shortly, but if we go down deeper into this element, that'd be great.
Just harking back to the Bougainville situation, you know, of course, the president of Bougainville was a leader during the resistance against Papua New Guinean rule. And this is an issue at the moment of what will unfold in sort of the months and years ahead, because Bougainville would like to hand over its powers from the central government in Moresby to Bougainville, well, certainly many of the powers by 2023, and then it hopes to have full independence by 2025. At the moment, James Marape, the Prime Minister, seems to be going along with this, but there is a lot of resistance in several levels of the Papua New Guinea government. And then we've had this extraordinary situation, really, of just in the last few days, where Parliament resumed after some time of being inactive because of COVID-19, when a number of MPs were found to have it. And so it reopened this week, and the extraordinary scenes of the Parliament being absolutely empty, with the Merapi's government MPs having a major meeting, planning a meeting, and then the opposition MPs were also having meetings. So you had the Speaker attending Parliament by himself. So he adjourned Parliament. But it, you know, it's a very worrying thing that, you know, democracy is so important in Papua New Guinea at the moment, to have Parliament and the scenes that actually sets to the country of, well, you know, how disrespectful and how irresponsible members of Parliament are.
Well, let's pick up on that democratic theme.
So that's,
Paul, David, I'd just like to pick up on that democratic theme, or the impacts on democracy as you outlaid there. Hand over to Paul for, Paul, if you and David can thrash this out. I know, Paul, you had a couple of issues that you wanted to put to David relating to governance.
Yeah, and by the way, David, it's great to have you on the show and have your expertise brought to bear on these podcasts. I think some of our regular listeners from far away will be enlightened by your comments. My interest is this. There is a concern that the pandemic was a precipitant for a generalized crisis of governance, both in the democratic and non-democratic world. But what it's done most dangerously is undermine democracy, including mature democracies, liberal democracies, dare I say, the United States. But it's undermined democracies, and it's strengthened the hand of authoritarians who are already in power, but also wannabe authoritarians who would use the democratic system to their advantage. And one of the ways they do so is to use public health orders in order to stifle dissent, to do that sort of thing. And that feeds into that negative loop whereby people start thinking about the deep state, and you're going to get chips implanted in you if you get vaccinated, and, you know, all that nonsense. But the truth is, we're seeing this crisis, and this crisis, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, are these crises related in the main? That is, the pandemic precipitated a crisis of faith, or are actually the specifics of each country and region so specific that you can't generalize off of a global pandemic? I have other reasons to think the crisis of governance is more than just the precipitant of the pandemic, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I think that essentially there is a pattern, certainly right through, well, there's the global pattern, as you've referred to, about the erosion of democracy, particularly by not only the authoritarians, but the wannabe authoritarians. And there are, all, you know, there's been a tendency for wannabe authoritarians in the Pacific for a very long time. So this is a very convenient excuse, the pandemic crises, particularly, as I mentioned, in Papua New Guinea and Fiji. And then, of course, in the background, we've got the rivalry between China and the United States and its proxy, Australia. It's interesting that in the Southeast Asian region, there's countries that have taken that Chinese vaccines, particularly the Sinovac, is the most prevalent one in Philippines and Indonesia, for example. The sort of moves by China to have much more of a role Combating COVID-19 in the region. And China has been playing a very strong role in many countries in the Pacific for a long time to gain influence on infrastructure, a massive infrastructure, ports and such like. And there's been a lot of controversy about that. And of course, with COVID-19, it sort of creates something of a smokescreen, I think, in terms of sort of washing over what some governments are doing in the region. And in Papua New Guinea, we've got a situation there where James Marape was elected, as prime minister. Well, he came in as prime minister and unseated Peter O'Neill, who was one of the major authoritarians for many years, in fact, right on the road to becoming a full-blown dictator. Fortunately, he was ousted, and of course, a key opposition person now. Well, he is at the moment facing a commission of inquiry into a fairly massive loan issue. I'll just check to my figures here that I've got on that because he's just spoken fairly stridently against his former colleagues, who largely were the backbone, if you like, of James Marape's new government that has been in power for quite some time now, and branding them as cowardly because he says that the whole government was responsible for this massive $1.2 billion loan acquired in 2014 from the Swiss bank UBS. And there were Sydney consultants that actually sort of eased this loan. It was to buy shares in Oil Search, the biggest oil and gas company in Papua New Guinea. They lost a massive $432 million as a result of this. Well, so the Commission of Inquiry is trying to get to the bottom of this, what actually happened there. James Marape, the Prime Minister now, was in actual fact the Finance Minister at this time. So it certainly seems on the face of it that there's some culpability within the current government as well as O'Neill's previous government. All these are playing out in the middle of the COVID crisis. And people like Port Moresby is a very interesting capital in the sense that it is entirely dependent largely on connections to the rest of the country by air and by sea, of course, as well. It's a long way around. There are no actual road connections to the second largest city, for example, Leh in the northern part of the country, although there's a new highway gradually being built between Leh and Moresby. Coming back to the border issue of, along with Papua, West Papua, this, to my mind, is one of the major security issues, the whole West Papua issue, and something that's largely ignored by New Zealand media, for example, and much of the media, apart from the Pacific countries that take considerable interest and support in many ways for the West Papuan struggle for self-determination and independence. This whole border issue is not only critical about COVID-19 and the spread of this, but also about a major security issue. And this is an underwriting issue, if you like, of the Melanesian Spearhead Group.
I was just going to get to that. And just to underscore, David, that there is talk that border will open up, isn't there?
There's certainly been talk. Marape has actually had a meeting with, I think it's about last week or so, with the Indonesian ambassador in Port Moresby, and very much they seem to be very keen on opening that border. But the general feeling is it's actually got the real reason for that, although there's certainly some economic factors, because the trade between Vanimo, for example, and Jayapura, and the fact that they're you know, people across both sides of the border, you know, for generations have moved fairly freely. But that's not really the real reason. The real reason is about freedom of movement for Indonesian forces. Although, of course, it would never be admitted, but the Indonesians want to be able to follow resistance fighters cross border and that sort of thing.
Let's pick up on that and Indonesia's influence. And is it destabilizing the Melanesian Spearhead Group, one of the significant players in the region, a body, a bloc that is representative of the main states throughout Melanesia, isn't it? Including Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Bougainville, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, etc. So we'll just take a quick transition. We'll get back into looking at Indonesia's influence and what it is attempting to do with the Melanesian Spearhead Group. And then we'll get into Fiji on the back of that. So bear with us. Paul, can you just give us a rundown on the importance of regional blocs and how they work from an effective point of view within larger blocs? For example, in the Pacific, many outside probably aren't aware of it, but there's the Pacific Island Forum, which is a representative bloc of many nations in the region, including Australia and New Zealand, Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, or the Melanesian states we just mentioned. Can you talk to us? And we see also, obviously, representation from French Polynesia, France itself. We see the United Nations represented at these summit meetings, and we also see the United States, usually an undersecretary of Secretary of State, you know, that type of level, coming down and engaging in the post-forum dialogues. Now, can you talk to us in general for a couple of minutes about the importance of such blocks and blocks within blocks? And this is what we're talking about here when we go back to David, is the Melanesian Spearhead Group that actively takes part in, within the Pacific region.
Although I'll do it as a preface to getting back to David there. So regional aggregations of countries are usually based on, you know, commonality of interests more than geographic location. The Southwest Pacific, the Western Pacific, has got a number of interesting wrinkles to it. The partition into Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia, of course, has been fraught from the get-go. And now we've seen the Micronesians leave the Pacific Island Forum. But what's interesting is usually regional aggregations and their subgroups are designed to overcome issues that cannot be overcome bilaterally. So, for example, the dispute between Indonesia and Papua, you usually pitch that up to a higher entity and compromises are worked out. Now, I noticed, and again, part of my pleasure in seeing David here was I was doing some background reading, and I found to my astonishment that Indonesia is an associate member of the Melanesian Spearhead Group, but West Papua is just an observer. And I noticed, well, that there's obviously a diplomatic conundrum that has to be solved. But then I realized that the MSG has not really met as a forum for at least a year and then more. They keep on scheduling meetings and then giving up on that. So I thought to myself, could it be, perhaps precipitated by the pandemic, that the MSG is essentially a paper-only entity at this moment in time? And if so, where to from here, given that the PIF, the Pacific Island Forum, I won't say that it's in the process of decline or disintegration, but it is certainly in distress. The Micronesians have left, and here's where we get into great power politics and strategic reasoning, because the Micronesians, they have reason to want to leave that goes beyond the fact that their gentleman's agreement to assume the presidency of the secretariat of the PIF was reneged, mostly at the behest of Australia, New Zealand, and France. So now we're getting, you know, these colonial powers beginning to pull the levers that are creating factions within the PIF. And quite frankly, without the Micronesians, although again, I know their interests lie elsewhere, in some respects, you have the makings of potential disintegration. So my interest here is, A, the regional organizations that could overcome some of these bilateral tensions, cross-cultural tensions, are conspicuous by their absence. And what can be done to reinvigorate these regional forums so that they're effective interlocutors and mediators for the disputes that we see ongoing, not only in Melanesia, but through the region as a whole?
David, over to you. Can you pick up on those points there?
Yes. Well, I think it's a fairly disastrous situation with the Melanesian spearhead group. It was a huge mistake to allow Indonesia to become a member in the first place. And it's been an ongoing thorn of discontent for those countries supporting West Papuan independence, such as Vanuatu, that that the West Papuans only have observer status. And of course, they've been lobbying for quite some time now for full membership. But Indonesia sabotages that step by step. Indonesia uses Papua New Guinea and Fiji as a Trojan horse in the Melanesian spearhead group. It has enormous influence in both countries through aid, through military aid, and through other aid as well. For example, Fiji has benefited from aid after cyclones and so on. At the moment, Papua New Guinea is benefiting from military aircraft engines just being supplied to the country. But it goes on all the time. And of course, there's always allegations about, sort of the envelope diplomacy for members of parliament in Papua New Guinea. Indonesia itself has an extraordinarily developed strategic diplomacy campaign, if you like, to influence Pacific countries, not just the Melanesian states, but all the Pacific countries, but particularly targeting the Melanesian spearhead group. So we've got probably the most divided group, the MSG is the most divided it's probably ever been. And once again, the COVID, excuses for delays in the meetings and so on. It's also Indonesia in the background pushing for delays, just as it has delayed the promised visit by the United Nations rapporteur on human rights. And human rights violations at the moment are really rife, and probably the worst has been for several years now, because earlier this year, well, of course, what happened was that the Jakarta branded the OPM a terrorist organization, effectively that has meant that other activist groups and so on that don't have armed resistance but by association are treated as terrorists, quote unquote. But it also means that it tars almost all activists in West Papua as being potentially branded terrorists, and therefore they can fit with sort of immediate arrest and so on with minimal accountability. Not that there was ever much accountability for the Indonesian security forces anyway. At the moment, 21,000 troops are in West Papua, and there's been controls on internet, so there's very little information that's actually been able to percolate out, as some does, of course. For example, I think of the case of Victor Yamo. For example, he's a civilian leader. He was the international spokesperson for the West Papua National Committee, a movement that's a peace, working through peaceful means and so on. He was arrested about 3 months ago, no charge, thrown into the Brumont military compound. His health has dramatically deteriorated in those last 3 months. Of course, undoubtedly, the Indonesian authorities would be quite happy if he passed away in a tragedy like that. But, that sort of situation has happened many times. There have been many people who have spoken out internationally. Veronica Koman, who's a civil rights lawyer and an Indonesian, has spoken out just in the last few days and saying that you've got to release this guy, otherwise he's probably going to die. Some people are pressing just for him to be transferred to Alibaba prison in Jayapura, the capital, where it's a little bit easier to have access to him for lawyers, etc., and that sort of thing. Veronica Koman, the lawyer that has spoken out, she says, well, it's, it's just like going from one tiger pen to another tiger pen,
Let's pick up on this element, David. With respect to the Melanesian Spearhead Group, the MSG as we're referring it to, if I just go back in time a little bit here, immediately prior to the Frank Bainimarama coup, if we put it that way, and right on the eve of that, of course, Prime Minister Ngarase was still in power in Fiji. We saw the Melanesian Spearhead Group very effective at the Pacific Island Forum at that particular year. What we saw was, for example, Ramsey, or the Regional Assistance to the Solomon Islands, which was a grouping, wasn't it, to create stability in the Solomons when it was in crisis. And that was led by all the countries of the Pacific. A non-aggression pact, for example, had been signed up in Townsville, where the Solomons were assured that the countries of the Pacific, of the Pacific Island Forum that went there with their military, were not taking over. They were creating the opportunity for Solomon Islands to get back on task. Now, that had been going for a couple of years or so, but RAMSI, as it was called, the Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands, it was seen by those in Melanesia, those leaders in Melanesia, particularly led by Sogavare, the Prime Minister of the Solomons at that time, that Ramsey was holding it like with an iron fist, and it was demanding that the Australians release it more, let that fist relax more to hand over a transition to power. We saw, for example, the Melanesian Spearhead Group leaders, and they basically ran this down and drove this idea to John Howard, the Prime Minister of Australia at the time, and Helen Clark, the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Helen Clark came out and suggested there's movement. Then Sogavare comes out and he says, we have a 5-point plan that the Australians and New Zealand and the rest of the nations of the Pacific have agreed to, and it was one of bringing back stability. We saw the MSG absolutely taking control of that situation and for the region's benefit. Now, a comparison to now, with Indonesia on board in the MSG, and there's arguments that it's moves to make it more impotent, if we put it so crudely. Do you see a situation evolving in the wider Pacific where the Melanesians lose their voice because they've been divided?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've seen that fairly dramatically over the last couple of years, 3 years or so. It's going to get worse because Indonesia has the ear of both the two most influential and powerful countries in the region, Papua New Guinea and Fiji. Although the West Papuans have enormous support from Vanuatu and the Solomon Islands, and also the FMKS representation of Kaneki New Caledonia, they are essentially outflanked by the two main Melanesian countries in the grouping. And all the time, the influence is working through Australia and New Zealand, because I think both countries, it's absolutely appalling, the position taken over this, given the security implications for the whole region. And we're seeing a lot being invested in this massive diplomacy in the region. And we're also seeing it at another level, sort of a more covert level from the Indonesians. The employment of, or deployment rather, of sort of political trolls. that run a Kent, because the thing is that with the West Papuans, they've been enormously successful, I think, in the last 5 years using social media. And although it's a little in a little bit of retreat at the moment because of the controls on the internet in the Papuan region that the Indonesians have placed, they've still been very successful at actually sort of galvanizing support at the grassroots level right across the Pacific. I think the support for ordinary people in the Pacific for the West Papuan cause and for the MSG taking a much stronger stance on this is growing quite exponentially. But at the same time, you've got this covert operations, if you like, of Jakarta and using these Trojans. You notice that on websites and where sources of good information come out on West Papua, there are constant, I just noticed on my own Facebook page a couple of days ago, there was a report that we had about Victor Yamo's case and a very strong, it was actually from an Indonesian media source. It was very well researched and well written and that sort of thing. We had on my link on the Facebook page, I had 10 messages within a matter of a couple of hours. Nine of them were in Bahasa Indonesian. But I could at least can see what was, you know, more or less being expressed, and one was in English. And the characteristic of these is very abusive and full of disinformation.
Well, and just for the audience's sake, David runs, he's the editor of AsiaPacificReport.nz. And I know David and even my own networks have been the recipients of many what I would term, David, as psychological operations or PSYOPs coming out of the Indonesians with respect to letters to the editor on anything relating to human rights. And it's certainly very, very active. Now, at this point, we'll just go to a transition. We'll come back and I'd like to see an interaction. We'll present an interaction between Paul and David on Fiji and exactly what is happening there. Yeah, Paul, so what we've heard there is the importance of the regional blocks. We've seen what is going on. David's taken us through a detailed explanation of one of the significant external powers in some respects, Indonesia, and the makeup, if you like, of all of the nations of the Pacific region. Just at this point, what we'd just like to pick up on now is that there is concerns inside Fiji that what we are seeing are the precursors to an abandonment of democracy once again. I'd put it that way. If you feel that's incorrect, I'd love to be challenged on it. But what I'm talking about here, and it's something that David has alluded to as well, that and has certainly reported on strongly, that there is a growing voice of those that are critiquing the current incumbent inside Fiji, the government of former military leader and former coup leader, democratically elected Frank Bainimarama. Now, that criticism from politicians, opposition politicians, has been resisted in a more draconian way as we understand it, and certainly the activist community has been dealt to in such ways by way of detention. So, Paul, what do you make of this destabilisation that we're observing, once again, from afar right now? And secondly, what do you think is the influence over the security fabric of this region, of which we know geopolitically and globally is of vital importance at this time?
Yeah, well, I don't disagree that, democracy such as it is in Fiji is under threat. I'll preface this by saying that I'm scratching my head at the attitude of the other MSG parties, although David's explained it very well. The traditional concern within the Pacific Island Forum was that it was dominated by Australia and New Zealand, that they were the puppet masters and they played the game to get various factions aligned or not, and that this has actually been at play in the violation of the gentleman's agreement allowing the Micronesians to take over the presidency of the PIF. And so for the Melanesian spearhead group to allow itself to be manipulated by the Indonesians, knowing full well that the best outcome for the Indonesians is a weakening of the MSG and an undermining of independence movements that could channel support within the MSG, again, has me scratching my head. I'm just, what are they thinking? And sure, envelope diplomacy may be part of the answer. I'm sure the Chinese have something to say, excuse me, but it's a mystery to me, to say the least. Now, with regards to Fiji, you know, Selwyn knows, and David, you may know, that I come from a long line of political scientists that study transitions from authoritarianism to democracy and from democracy to authoritarianism. And a while back, I wrote a piece and I said, well, what Bainimarama is trying to do with the elections is what Pinochet tried to do in Chile. That is, transition not to a liberal democracy, to what is known as a guarded democracy or a hard democracy, where the military has veto power over whatever the civilian government does, except that the Commodore has the military on his side. That's a little wrinkle. Pinochet tried that, and to their credit, the Chilean people rejected that proposition and have managed to stave off the authoritarian impulses of the Chilean right to this day. It seems to me that Bainimarama never intended to democratize fully. What he is more akin to are the secular nationalists that we saw in the 50s and 60s in the Middle East, guys like Nasser, like Saddam Hussein in the early days, where they sort of stifled all non-national conflicts, in, you know, be it tribal, be it ethno-religious, in the quest for modernity. And so part of the agenda was to tap down arguments amongst chiefs and this sort of thing in order to modernize Fiji and make it the hub for trade and commerce in the South Pacific. Well, the pandemic has, you know, has put paid to that, in part because of the incompetence exhibited by the Bainimarama regime. And I notice, I forget his name, but the Attorney General, also known as the Minister for Everything, he was laid up sick in Singapore for 9 months. I mean, apparently he's gravely ill. He's back in Fiji, and he's not involved in anything. And the health minister is clearly an incompetent. And then Bainimarama himself disappeared for a while. This is of grave concern, because when he did reappear, the first thing he did was use the public health crisis to start stifling and stamping down on dissenters who very rightfully are saying, what's going on here? I mean, you know, why is there no coherent response to pandemic mitigation? He turned it into a political issue. So my question, David, I guess, is am I correct to say that what we see is a hardening of this guarded democracy in response to the crisis caused by the pandemic? And if that's the case, then the ultimate arbiters of where Fiji are going to go once again will be the armed forces.
David?
Well, yes, I would agree. I would agree in many, many respects to that that scenario. But yes, definitely a hardening of the guided democracy and a sheltering behind the COVID-19, because clearly if it's left to democracy, the Fiji First government is going to fall next year. And there's a lot of speculation that by addressing COVID-19 increasingly as a security issue rather than a health issue, and particularly because the health strategy has failed in the sense that Fiji depended too much on putting all the eggs in the in a vaccination campaign, although that has been progressing quite. That's been the one good thing about the campaign, is that there's actually that part has been quite successful. But overall, they're dealing with COVID-19 has been an absolute disaster, and the people know that. And so it's a very widespread feeling that, well, they go to the polls next year when the election's due, this government's going to fall. But the feeling now is that very much that by making it more of a security issue, the Bainimarama's government will be able to sort of declare, well, you know, it's a security issue, we have to delay the elections, you know.
David, sorry to interject, David, on that point, you were in Fiji up close and personal observing with many other student journalists as well at the time of the spate coup. You've seen, for example, it was referred to in the Pacific in colloquial terms very often that it's coup season. Are you picking up that democracy would be abandoned or just postponed should...
Well, my own personal view, it's been a pseudo-democracy anyway. From both the elections, 2014, of course, that was the objective, you know, to have this fig leaf of democracy by being elected at the time. It's successful then. Of course, Fiji First considerably has reduced margin in the 2018 election. But certainly they won't win an election if it's held next year. That's all the indications that we have. So this is the strategy now, to turn it into much more of a security issue and to take a hardline position on policies. It's been a hallmark of the Bainimarama government that there's almost minimal public consultation about any kind of policy whatsoever. Think of what happened with the 2013 constitution, you know, where there was even a referendum and so on. Discussion with the people by and large, but the Bainimarama government went ahead with its own version of what the constitution was going to be. And then there's the speculation, of course, that Bainimarama is not really the prime minister at all. He's the prime minister in name, but about the real person who's pulling the strings is Ayaz Saad Kaum, the attorney general and the minister of everything, as Paul mentioned. That's how many Fijians certainly see it. And I think what we've seen recently with the clampdown on dissent is a clear illustration of this, you know, with the recent the Aitoka land bill. That's the law that so-called reforms, I can't say that they're reforms at all, but the changes that were introduced by the Bainimarama government, there are those who supported it by saying that it would make it easier for development, particularly land development in Fiji for economic purposes. However, there's been a wide range of criticism at different levels. One level was suggesting that it was actually a Muslim conspiracy. We have to take into account that Ayaz is Muslim and some of his key people that he has in government. But that's a pretty extreme position that was being taken by some. The more moderate position was that by changing this law, it would make it easier for investors and so on to simply override the landowning, indigenous landowning holdings. It's 84% of the land in Fiji is inalienable.
There's certain irony in that, isn't there, David?
Yes, it is.
Going back to previous coups, for example, there were two bills, weren't they, or two moves by the Ngarase government that gave the opportunity for Frank
Bainimarama.
Yeah, the Golikoli bill and the peace and reconciliation with respect to Spate and his people. So there's an irony in that, do you see?
Absolutely. I think it's very, very ironical that this is happening now. But of course, the big criticism by people by and large is there's no public consultation. And any attempt at having discussion and debate in Parliament was simply jumped on by the Bainimarama government. And that's why we had nine people being picked up, mostly members of Parliament and opposition, people like Professor Bimal Prasad. He's an economist, by the way, an excellent economist. And people, you know, take his perspectives quite seriously. But essentially, and try and intimidate these people hauled them in for questioning. Some of them faced several bouts of questioning and so on over merely challenging this bill and pointing out the weaknesses of it and the risks. The risks are that a system of subleasing and so on, eventually have land effectively becomes alienated because of land when land is improved structures and things that are built on the land, that sort of thing, it becomes virtually impossible for the actual landowners to take the land back because they haven't got the money to cover this. So it's a highly controversial issue, and obviously needed serious debate and not hasty sort of decisions. Well, as I understand it, basically the bill has gone through. It's effectively becoming law, and so Sitiven Rumbuka, who has one of the people hauled in for questioning and has challenged it, said, well, there's nothing to be done now. What we have to do is change the government next year, and then that law can be reversed. But this is another irony that, so we've got the two major leaders in Fiji at the moment are both coup leaders.
Yeah, former coup leaders.
So Sitiveni Rumbuka, who started the coup culture, if you like.
Back in the 80s.
Back in 1987, yes, with two coups in the same year. And now he's seen to be a much more benign character these days, so you've got him on one level, but of course he stepped down from leadership of the SADLP party, and so he wants to start his own party for the next election. So you've got him on one flag, and Bainimarama, the current coup leader, who led the coup to end all coups, and of course nobody really believes that, on the other corner, in between. Democracy's suffering enormously.
David,
I was just going to say, it's interesting, David, as you speak, I was thinking of another axiom of transitology, which is that democracy is not consolidated until there's a peaceful rotation in office between governments, and then there's another one. So it yes. is not enough to hold open elections and have a government for one or two terms. You need to give up power peacefully and see what the opposition does with it.
Yes.
That will be the test of the Fijian regime. I don't think it will pass the test, but at least it will then be exposed for the charade or the sham democracy that you suspect it really is, and I tend to agree that you'll be right.
Yes.
To both of you, thank you very much for this episode. And remember, this is part one of a two-part special looking at stability, COVID-19, with respect to the wider Pacific region. In this episode, of course, we have dug deep down into the Melanesian elements of the Pacific. We will return, we expect, next week. Potentially, we will pick this up maybe in 14 days' time, depending on availabilities. But we'd like to continue this on, and we look forward to your company once again when we come back to dig into part two of COVID-19 and stability issues with respect to the Pacific, and we'll do a deep dive into the Polynesian axis of this wonderful blue ocean region of the world. Until that time, thank you very much, and thank you to Paul, and thank you to David for your time in there.